les communautés autochtones et on parlera aussi un peu de la situation du Québec, j'espère. Mes excuses que je ne pouvais pas être ici ce matin. There was a direct departmental chairs meeting this afternoon. There's a faculty council meeting this late afternoon. There's Yom Kippur and tomorrow. So I apologize. I wish I could be here, but I'm very happy at this panel, which features two experts on Indigenous communities and Quebec. We, unfortunately, Val Napoleon, who was supposed to be here, could not be here today. That means we will have more time for lunch, but less time for her thoughts. We do start today with Jean Leclerc, and he will be followed immediately by Audrey Macklin. I would ask you to hold your questions until the end.
Thank you very much. First of all, in my name and Audrey's, I think it's very awkward for us to be non-Indigenous peoples and speaking on this panel without Val being there. So I have to, we haven't decided this. We would have enjoyed having an indigenous intellectual, but we can't knit one. First of all, I would like to acknowledge that Glengarry College is situated on the traditional territory of the Mississaugas of New Credit First Nation, and I thank the organizers for inviting me to participate in this conference. I want to take the opportunity also to dedicate this talk and to both my mentors, gigantic legal minds, François Chevrette from my own faculty, and Rod McDonald from McGill. Professor Stephen Holmes of NYU has stated, quote, that the most democratic reason why elites have proved willing to impose limits on themselves is that such limits help to mobilize the voluntary cooperation of non-elites in the pursuit of the elite's most highly prized objectives, especially revenue extraction, revenue victory in war, and their holding on to power. Holmes continues, full-fledged democracy has always been and will always remain an aspiration, more an aspiration than a reality. But genuinely democratic episodes occur when powerful actors discover, as they sometimes do, a palpable advantage in popular participation, government transparency, protection for minorities, and uncensored debates. Finally, he claims that, quote, if you wish a constitutional norm to govern the way politicians behave, you need to organize politically to give ruling groups an incentive to pay attention and accept the restraints on their own discretion for their benefit and yours, unquote. How did Quebec succeed in getting the English-speaking Canadian social political elites to limit their own power as it was institutionalized in our federal political institutions? What are the prospects for Canada's Indigenous peoples to get the non-Indigenous population of Canada, including Quebec's, to limit their own power as it is presently institutionalized in our federal and provincial political institutions? Let us recall that federalism is based on a mixture of self-rule, autonomy of the federated entities, and shared rule, participation of the latter in the exercise of federal power within the federal institutions. However, since 1867, because of our Senate's inability to play its role as a chamber of regions, and thus because of the limitations of Canada's shared rule regime, Quebec has always stressed the autonomy dimension of the federal dyad. Indigenous peoples, having been denied either self-rule or shared rule, in fact, having been crushed under the federal imperium, it is no wonder that their foremost wish is not so much participation in the federal institutions as gaining a measure of constitutionally guaranteed autonomy. This quest for greater autonomy also has to do with both Quebec's and the Indigenous people's sense of their political and cultural specificity, what they would describe as their nationhood. Nationalism not only serves as the symbolic embodiment of their undeniable difference, it is also a powerful and inexpensive means of generating political power in their respective struggles for greater autonomy. It is no wonder, then, that minorities should resort to nationalism. The majority's own unwitting sense of being the sole true nation Andrew Coyne's piece proves a paradigmatic example of this, and its unwillingness to formally acknowledge Quebec's or the Indigenous people's distinct status as constituent actors of the federal polity explains the ongoing resilience of the nationalist movements. However politically and symbolically powerful the minority's nation-to-nation discourse might be, I wish to underline some of its downsides. First, because it emphasizes autonomy rather than participation, Quebec and Indigenous nationalist discourses often embrace the perspective of methodological nationalism or methodological holism. That raises serious epistemological difficulties. Allow me to explain. In such a perspective, federalism is envisioned as having to do with the reconciliation of groups and nations, groups whose members are often implicitly conceptualized as culturally homogeneous and politically unanimous, and members that are also assumed forever to put the interests of the minority nation over and above everything else, that is, as preferring collective liberty over personal interests, whatever the circumstances might be. These monistic conceptions of identity do recognize the multiplicity and legitimacy of our personal identity markers, religion, race, language, sexual orientation, etc., but they only do so as long as these are deployed within the confines of one single nation. Once these markers take the form of allegiances to other political communities, nationalists draw the line. It thus becomes difficult for them to explain, in terms other than deprecatory, the wish of some of their constituent members not to follow the sovereign one-way street they propose. Second, this methodological mindset also leads to a form of constitutional fetishism. Because minorities do not benefit as much as the majority from political participation within the federal institutions, minority nationalists often look to the formal constitution as the sole means of ensuring their collective existence. The judicial interpretation given by the Supreme Court to sections 91 and 92 of the Constitution Act of 1867, or to section 35 of the Constitution Act 1982, therefore takes center stage in their assessment of the appropriateness of Canada's federal constitutional structure. The exclusivity principle enshrined in section 91 and 92, and still understood in Quebec as providing for watertight compartments, remains the mantra of all Quebec governments, the PLQ included. As for the speeches of Indigenous leaders, they are also steeped in constitutional vocabulary. Words and expressions such as Aboriginal rights and titles, treaties, inherent sovereignty, punctuating every single one of their official statements. Although perfectly understandable, this attitude gives pride of place to the formal constitution and to treaties to the detriment of the material constitution. To use the vocabulary of the 18th century British constitutionalist Walter Bagehot, Quebec and Canada's Indigenous peoples focus their attention on the dignified as opposed to the efficient part of the constitution. In so doing, however, they downplay the importance and the usefulness of more prosaic means of resolving jurisdictional issues, in the case of Quebec, or of implementing a measure of self-government where Indigenous peoples are concerned. In Quebec, asymmetrical intergovernmental agreements have successfully been concluded in, among other things, matters of health, immigration, manpower training, parental leaves. Some of the most important aspects of the Meech Lake Accord have been judicially recognized, but nobody cares about that because these arguments, these agreements, and these judicial reasonings are not chiseled in constitutional marble. As for Indigenous peoples, while one can understand their being uncomfortable with the idea of resorting to federal legislation as a means of allowing Indigenous communities to resort to their own legal traditions to regulate their internal affairs, still, it would constitute for them an infinitely easier path to follow than the laborious constitutional route. For instance, such legislation would most probably forego the constitutional requirement that, for indigenous normativity to be applicable in a certain sector, an indigenous group must establish that prior to contact, it regulated that particular field of human activity. Hence, contemporary norms applied by contemporary indigenous institutional actors and according to contemporary processes could be resorted to. I'll conclude with one last observation. Recall that Stephen Holmes stated that, quote, genuinely democratic episodes occur when powerful actors discover, as they sometimes do, a palpable advantage in popular participation, government transparency, protection for minorities, and uncensored debates, unquote. Such democratic episodes did occur in Canada. For instance, in restraining its power by allowing both Quebec referenda on sovereignty to take place, the Canadian government has spared Canada from Spain's present fate. Most importantly, by refusing in 1977 to rekindle its defunct disallowance power to kill Quebec's Charter of the French Language, the federal government unwittingly sounded the death knell of the sovereignist project, or at any rate, severely curtailed its antagonistic proclivities towards the Constitution Act. Brian Miles, the editor-in-chief of Le Devoir, an independentist newspaper, eloquently put the point recently in an article celebrating the 40th anniversary of the Charter of the French Language. My translation, quote, Bill 101 was intended as a prelude to independence, but it proved so effective in convincing the sons and daughters of the French Canadians that they were finally maîtres chez eux, masters in their own house, that the siren songs of the yes were lost in the background. This is one of the paradoxes of which Quebecers have the secret. Our revolutions are quiet. Our quests for independence can do without a country, unquote. Quebec remains in Canada because the 1774 Quebec Act constitutionally guaranteed the survival of the civil law tradition. Because the 1867 Constitution Act, as interpreted by the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council, provided it with an important measure of political autonomy. And finally, because Quebec's Charter of the French Language ensured its cultural survival. Indigenous peoples are claiming the very same things for very similar reasons. Why deny them something that proved successful in the case of Quebec? The blunt answer is that Quebec nationalism had the potential of leading to Canada's demise, not so with Indigenous nationalism. In the harsh words of Thomas Flanagan, two nations are a threat, but 600 are an inconvenience. As a way to conclude, since my time is up, I'll just say that organizing themselves politically to give ruling groups an incentive to pay attention will continue to be a hard task for Indigenous peoples because the Aboriginal rights doctrine developed by the Supreme Court of Canada has the structural effect of dividing them as opposed to uniting them. Thank you very much.
Merci beaucoup. On passe directement à Audrey Macklin.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the kind invitation to be here. I'd like to echo the words of introduction that Professor Leclerc gave about the panel and about our situation here. But I am really glad to have this opportunity to discuss with you a project that I've embarked on as a migration law scholar, which is my area of expertise, in which I am trying to take seriously my responsibility in my area of work to think hard about the relationship between migration, migrants, and refugees and indigeneity in Canada, something that has been assisted in my case enormously by a doctoral student of mine named Amar Bhatia, who has really pushed my thinking in, I hope, what are constructive ways. So what I'd like to do is just speak briefly about the project I'm embarking on and some of the questions that it has provoked in me. I don't have any answers for them, and I come here rather selfishly with the hope that if I put them out to you, this might elicit some conversation, ideas, and thoughts about how to move ahead in terms of understanding the relationship that we have, that Canada has, toward migration, refugees, citizenship, and the relationship that we have to Indigenous peoples. Now, Canada often describes itself and is described as a settler society. That term, in my view, is sort of Janus-faced, if you will. It has a facet that looks out at the world and one that looks inward. I mostly am engaged in the former one, the outward-looking one. And yet they rarely speak to one another. And so let me say this. In migration circles, being called a settler society has a largely positive valence. It's kind of a compliment. To the extent that one attaches positive value to relatively open immigration and citizenship policies. So settler societies, Canada, the US, Australia, New Zealand, Argentina, Brazil, and so on, are contrasted to countries more like the member states of the European Union or perhaps the Gulf states, where these states are also countries of immigration in the empirical sense. All countries of the world are. They receive large numbers of non-citizens who reside there for long periods of time, sometimes indefinitely. But settlement societies, those who are called settler societies, tend to embrace immigration as constitutive of the nation. You know, we are countries of immigration. We are built through immigration. That's part of the nation-building narrative. Whereas the default point of departure for other states is a view of migrants as a potential demographic, social, and cultural threat to the integrity of the nation. So in the outward-looking migration narrative, settler societies are cast as the good guys. And I'm not suggesting, you know, this is a story that has few heroes, and I'm not suggesting it's warranted. But that's where settler society sits. When we use the term settler society looking inward at Canada, as we increasingly do to describe non-Indigenous Canada, we're drawing attention to how Canada, as we know it, as a state, was founded on practices of dispossession, colonization, and the eradication of Indigenous peoples. So Canada as a state is founded on the settlement of Europeans and others on lands, inhabited by Indigenous peoples. And so it's a negative valence to talk of a settler society insofar as it draws attention, at a minimum, to the historic injustices at the core of the nation state's founding. I think the idea that those injustices are ongoing is sometimes accentuated by not just talking about settler society, but talking about non-Indigenous Canadians as settlers. And I think this is meant to be, and in some sense is, destabilizing. Now, it's odd in a sense that these conversations rarely happen together. These two faces of settler society rarely meet, because they're written into our history. And here, this I'm showing you here is one of the many treaties signed in the late 19th century. This is Treaty 6 on the territory of what is now mostly central Manitoba, between Indigenous communities there and the government. So it contains the preamble that is inserted into many such treaties, right? That the purpose of this treaty is to open up lands to settlement and immigration. This is the goal of these treaties, right? Settlement, immigration, and settlement is both the means and the end of the displacement and dispossession that is contemplated by the treaties. So it's baked right in at the very outset. Now, I'm going to pause for a moment on that and just return to saying what my research project concerns. So the title of the project I'm looking at is called Canada as Resettler Society. And I'm looking at the private sponsorship of refugees to Canada. Many of you may be familiar with this because there has been such a surge in private sponsorship of Syrian refugees in the last couple of years. It's a process whereby individuals gather together, form groups, raise money, and then are able to sponsor a refugee or refugee family from abroad who comes to Canada. They are, in fact, selected, vetted, cleared, transported by the Canadian government. But once they arrive, the sponsorship group undertakes responsibility to aid in the integration process. And most notably, that involves funding the family for a year at approximately the rates of social assistance, the same rates at which government-assisted or publicly sponsored refugees are supported. So private sponsors, in a sense, put up that money, they support refugees, and of course they aid in the very quotidian daily tasks of integration and settlement. Private sponsorship of refugees has garnered a lot of attention in Canada and around the world, and I think much of it is very positive attention. And the research I'm doing is on the role of sponsors. Who are they? What are their motivations? What is the mode of sponsorship? What are the tasks they perform? And perhaps most importantly for this piece of research, what is the effect on them and on Canadian society of undertaking this task that I will call making refugees into citizens? And in a sense, the research question I ask is, how does making refugees into citizens remake the citizenship of the sponsors who do it? That's, broadly speaking, my research question. But within that, there's an obvious question that needs to be asked. Okay? Refugee sponsorship is, in some sense, about enacting an idea of hospitality. And here in my project, I articulate different versions or iterations of hospitality that might be rooted in theories of cosmopolitanism, or in religion, or indeed in a particular kind of nationalism that, you know, not to be maple syrupy about it, but, you know, the way in which Prime Minister Trudeau has talked about this as, you know, welcome home to refugees. This is what we do as Canadians. It's part of being Canadian to welcome refugees. In whatever version one thinks about it, there is in play an idea of hospitality, I think. And hospitality, in turn, connotes the idea of welcoming people into what is your home. The problem, which I hope is now apparent, is what does it mean to call this place home and to welcome people into it when one's claim to it is contested, when it is unstable, when it is unresolved? Because what differentiates welcoming somebody from inviting someone to participate in a trespass is the legitimacy of your claim that this is really yours and your place. And so that has led me to start thinking about that problem. It has materialized in very concrete ways. Jean and I were talking about this, and here's a scenario that I have heard more than once, which is there is often, in discussions about refugee resettlement, indeed with various forms of what I will call humanitarian action, questions that arise if one takes a kind of cosmopolitan perspective. And the question comes, well, doesn't charity begin at home? Doesn't one owe special obligations to one's national kin, just as one understands one owes special obligations to one's family, right? Doesn't it begin at home? And so this has materialized in, among other things, some Indigenous people saying, it's, you know, I see you expending all of these resources as individuals to welcome refugees into Canada, bringing them quite literally into your home. Here we are, we live next to you. We experience extraordinary struggle. We don't have clean water. We don't have access to education and to jobs. Why are you directing all of this attention and energy there in the face of what is an ongoing injustice here in Canada amongst those who are also fellow Canadians? I don't think there is a particularly good answer to this, except, you know, to observe something that isn't really an answer, which is whatever the appropriate actions are, I'm not sure that the model of private sponsorship is in any way translatable to what we might think of as an appropriate response to the conditions of Indigenous peoples and the quite legitimate demands that they generate upon us. But having said that, okay, I think it opens up questions that we can think about more broadly. And here I just want to mention a few of them. Okay. What does it mean for us to welcome in the face of this kind of uncertainty about our claim to be home? What is the position of refugees or migrants in this relationship? So if we understand that we are in a treaty relationship with indigenous peoples, there are differing views about whether and why and how new immigrants and refugees, are they partners to the treaty? Are they in a different relationship to indigenous peoples because of the conditions upon which they enter? Are they part of settler society, or do they occupy some kind of different position and relationship? Okay. Does that depend on the reasons or mode by which they came to Canada? There are, and the Canadian Council for Refugees in its literature has talked about this, ways in which newcomers to Canada and Indigenous peoples can share certain kinds of experiences of persecution and injustice and so on. Okay? And in fact, there are refugees who are themselves Indigenous people who've been displaced from their traditional homes. But what more does it mean to say that there might be common experiences? Okay? The CCR, Canadian Council for Refugees, has also raised, I think, an interesting idea about the extent to which Indigenous people and refugees have claims to make with respect to Canada's international obligations that are as yet unmet or unfulfilled. Okay. And finally, the last one I'll raise is to the extent that we talk about being in a treaty relationship with Indigenous peoples, Canada claims for itself the power to exercise sole control over its borders and immigration. It also makes uniquely, the federal government in our Constitution, uniquely makes both Indians, in quotes, Indians and aliens, objects of the Constitution. The federal government exercises jurisdiction over them by virtue of status. It's a rare instance of authority over people as objects, not subjects of government. These are not topics or spheres of government. It's the federal government exercising authority over people as objects of governance. What does it mean, then, to be a meaningful partner in governance, to be subjects of the Constitution, if you are simultaneously an object of the Constitution? So there are, for reasons of time, I won't pursue this latter question. There are discussions out there about whether Indigenous people, Indigenous communities can exercise some authority over inward migration, whether that means to Canada or to Indigenous communities themselves. Okay? It's important in thinking about that question to recall that Indigenous people who are subject to the Indian Act have only one way of maintaining their status, and that is through a kind of descent rule, which, because of its nature, is rapidly disappearing those who are going to be having status. They are limited in the ability to people and repeople themselves. Right? Canada, the rest of Canada, is not. And so the last thing I'll leave you with is this. As we often do of immigrants, new Canadians, we expect things of them that we don't expect of ourselves. It's not a bad thing at all that we now have a proposal to put this into the oath of citizenship. In fact, I commend it, and though people might diminish it as merely symbolic, I think whatever its practical effects are, I think it puts a question on the table for all of us about what it actually means to faithfully observe our obligations as with respect to treaties with Indigenous peoples as citizens. So with that, I leave you. Thank you.
Alors, merci beaucoup, Audrey. Des questions profondes dans les deux interventions. On a une quinzaine de minutes pour des questions. 15-ish minutes for questions. Please come to the microphone. Oui.
Hello, my name is Tishini. I'm a Glendon alum here, and I think what both of you touched on is very present. I actually came back last week from a Black and Indigenous solidarity workshop, and the idea of being called a racialized settler and framing that and thinking about that was a very interesting kind of situation. So for me, I want to bring it back to the practical because I'm a policy specialist at heart. How do we, as people in this room, with that on the board right now, with I will faithfully observe laws of Canada, including treaties for Indigenous people, how do we put that into practice? How do we, as people in this room, as settlers, as refugees, how do we do that? And what kind of prescriptions do you have, whether it be through legal mechanisms or just civil society actions? So that's my question.
I don't have answers. That would not surprise you. Taking responsibility to teach ourselves and to educate others, I think, is important. I think if from the moment, certainly if we're talking about relationships with newcomers to Canada, if from the very moment one arrives, one understands that one is in a relationship with Indigenous peoples, I think that would be a significant change from the status quo. I know that this is something that several immigration agencies are working on. And I think that's, you know, in that particular relationship, that's a start. I think it's a set of difficult and uncomfortable questions, right? I don't think people feel very comfortable being called settlers. And my point here is not to definitively say that is an appropriate or inappropriate label, but to say it's worth having a conversation precisely about that and seeing where that goes. So I would think of that as a start. Thanks.
Well, last week I was in Edmonton and an elder spoke and to condemn the use of settler. So you did the, how can I put this? There are different situations, different sort of positions we can take on this. I think there are multiple things we can do. I think we, going back to the minister's conference, I think we should try at the level we are and where we are to make contact with the Indigenous peoples, learn to know them, ask questions, ask them how we can help. And sometimes it can be surprising. Because I was surprised when the elder spoke of that. But he found that to be unhelpful. That was his opinion. But then that's one elder's opinion. There are others that would think differently. I can't pretend that I knew much about Indigenous peoples prior to starting to teach that about 17 years ago. I made contact with people. I teach. I have 157 students in my class now, whereas at the beginning I had 20. So things are changing, and these incremental things. But on the part of the Indigenous peoples, I think it's going to take a lot of sit-ins. It's going to take some civil disobedience, because politics is an issue of power, and normative discourses on themselves do not change people. It's a power business too. So everything helps.
Sobering thought.
Hello, my name is Yasmin. I'm a graduate student of the Public and International Affairs Glendon School. I'd like to thank you all for your perspectives. They were very insightful. So my question is about recent discussions that have come forth by the federal government speaking about getting rid of the Indian Act. And like, you know, we know there are a lot of things missing from the Indian Act, things that are wrong with it, but ultimately it gives status, distinct status to First Nations, Inuit, and Métis people. And when we saw the previous government trying to omnibus and get rid of this bill without any alternative, there was a lot of resistance from the Indigenous communities, most notably with Idle No More. So I'm curious to know if there is a consensus within the Indigenous communities that there needs to be something to replace it. Is it like what do you envision this looking like? What kind of things would it include with respect to status or anything that you believe?
No, I don't know.
It's possible that this panel is not in the best position to answer that question.
No, I can give it a try.
Okay.
I think that the same reasons that called for not abrogating the Indian Act in 69 when the white paper was are still there. I don't think that, and I don't think people, because however warped the Indian Act is, it enabled communities to stay together on reserves. And I don't think that the Indigenous people want to lose that. They didn't want to lose that in 69. They don't want to lose that now. They want something different. Mm-hmm. But I'll use an Indigenous metaphor. There, Basil Johnson, who wrote magnificent book, he's an elder, an Anishinaabe elder, speaks of Nanabush or Nanabuzu. He's a trickster in the Anishinaabe cosmology. And Nanabuzu has this incredible faculty of morphing himself in different things. He can be a cloud, he can be a rabbit, he can be an eagle. But once he adopts a particular shape, that shape limits what he can do. As a rabbit, he can't fly. As an eagle, he can't, you know, hop around in the tall grass. So my answer is, I think there are different avenues that will be characterized by their own limits. Some nations are capable, because they have the power to do so, to have treaties signed. Others are unable to do so. So as I was saying, federal legislation might be helpful in their case. Some indigenous communities prefer to stay completely outside of legal law. And they prefer what we call an extra pluralisme extra-étatique, pluralism outside of the state. That's their choice. So they're going to be, how about the urban indigenous population? So I think that choices will have to be made, but these choices will entail their limits. But I think if we ask the indigenous peoples what they want, and they're so different, we have a sense sometimes that the indigenous are like a duplicata, you know, you stretch it and all the figures are the same, but they're radically different. And I'm talking here while Kent is there, and Kent is even more knowledgeable than me on all these things, so maybe he would have a guess of what would be an appropriate remedy.
Thank you.
I'll just add a very short word in that I don't have an answer to your question, so I'll just say something about something I do know about, kind of way. But if you think about what nations typically claim for themselves, it is the ability to define who they are as a nation. It's important to realize just what a deviation and distortion from that the Indian Act is. You can't get back to zero, and that's why I don't have the expertise to provide an answer about where you go from this incredibly distorted situation that now obtains. But the idea of being able to define who you are and how you carry on that identity is something that is so taken for granted in citizenship, right? Imagine if the United States purported to define what Canadian citizenship was for Canadians, right? I mean, if you think that sounds absurd and kind of crazy, well, it's important to think about how the Indian Act does that for Indigenous people. And once you sort of see that as a starting point, then the urgency of enabling Indigenous people the ability to work, to think through what they prioritize in terms of identity and how that is created and transmitted, I think, becomes more obvious.
Which could cause tensions, right? Mm-hmm. If you have the pluralism idea, what if some First Nation decides to do something in ways that could violate the Canadian Charter, then, right, this is a question. Okay, next question.
Yes, Kent McNeil from Osgoode Hall Law School. I'm not going to take your offer, John, to address the Indian Act question. I think the two of you have dealt with it very well. So, but I do have another question, and it relates to, you know, the place of Indigenous governments within or without the Canadian Constitution. So, you know, we've got Section 35 of the 1982 Constitution Act, which can be regarded as providing the constitutional space for a third order of government within Canada's federal system. But the way the Supreme Court to date has dealt with that issue, I mean, you referred to the Pamajuan decision, where they have to prove that they regulated this matter back prior to contact with Europeans. I mean, it's just absurd, right? Just going nowhere in terms of an inherent right to self-government. So, but, you know, the court might move in different directions beyond that. But not all Indigenous people are happy with that constitutional space. So the Haudenosaunee, for example, my understanding is that they say, well, we're not part of the Canadian Constitution, and they issue their own passports, and they want a relationship with Canada that's truly nation to nation, not within Canada as such, right? I was intrigued by John White's point at the very end, where he talked about Indigenous peoples and the Canadian relationship with them maybe be not a constitutional matter, but a matter of diplomacy. And so I just wonder if you could comment on that and what your thoughts are.
Well, I'd agree with John if diplomacy entailed an immediate, identical power between the partners in the negotiation. Only small nations with nuclear weapons can threaten a stronger one. And so the level at which negotiation, diplomatic negotiations start are determined by Canadian constitutional law. What makes the Haudenosaunee so powerful is because they know how to deploy power at the political level. Things are not done on Haudenosaunee territory because the governments are afraid. So in other situations, and you referred to it, the Constitution, contrary to what the general Canadians think, that, you know, the Supreme Court is giving away Canada to the Indigenous peoples. As you know, it's unbelievably difficult for Indigenous peoples to establish an Aboriginal right, or even worse, an Aboriginal title, or as you mentioned, an Aboriginal right to self-govern. So I think that we have, I'm talking you and me as lawyers, as teachers, to find ways, as you do constantly for 20 years, at finding ways of enabling the common law system that we have that determines what are the rights of Indigenous people to broaden itself. And I think that the Supreme Court is slowly changing things. For instance, who would have thought in 1996, when the Pamajawan case you mentioned was rendered, that in 2005 the Hayden decision would be rendered? I don't think at the time nobody thought about that. And I think that in Chilcotin, the court turned the screws a little bit, introduced the idea of consent, which was not there prior to that. And I'm a great believer in small steps. I know that saying that to Indigenous people is an insult to their intelligence, because they've been, you know, making these really tiny steps. But I think that things are happening. We're not where we were in 1982. And I think the Supreme Court will not be able to avoid recognizing a generic right to some sort of self-government. It can't. It's impossible. Imagine that one day somebody goes to the Supreme Court and says, we want to regulate, marital union. Will the court say, prove that you were marrying yourself prior to contact? These peoples were not animals. It will have to recognize in some areas an ability to resort to Indigenous normativity and Indigenous conflict resolutions. But then there will be a responsibility for Indigenous peoples to go out of the rhetoric system and devise political institutions for our contemporary world where power is unevenly distributed. Not everything works according to consensus in Indigenous liberty, Indigenous communities, and they will have a work to do also. And that's where Western constitutionalism might be useful for everyone. So basically, that's what I think.
Yeah, thank you very much for that hopeful answer, Jean.
Alors, on a le temps pour une dernière question, last question.
I'm a retired engineer, so I'm out of my depth. But I'll mention that I accept the title, the descriptor, settler or colonist, only because of the previous human beings who occupied the land. were here before us and how they were treated. And they described themselves as indigenous. They were here before us settlers. So I accept the title settler because it's a reminder of how they were treated and what their problems are as a result of treatment by people like me. So I don't have any problem with it. It's a good reminder these people exist. Now, as an engineer, it's appalling that I hear people living without water. It's crazy. And all us engineers have to do is the government throw money at it and put up goddamn water plants instead of buying F-18s or F-17s or 24s or whatever. Within 5 years, everybody kind of sparkling water. But I'm a settler, and anyone who ponders on the situation in Northern Ireland, for instance, that resulted from colonialism. And the people, it was ultimately a struggle, a battle, which I didn't approve of the warfare, but it was ultimately a battle between the group, the colonists, and the indigenous. And the indigenous remained being pissed off for 400 years. And there's a message there for Israel and other states. But sure, we need to accept the title, and that helps us focus on the fact that we've treated these indigenous people badly and we should do something about it.
Spoken like an engineer. All problems have solutions. Thank you. Maybe concluding thoughts from both of the presenters.
I hadn't thought of any. If you have something to
say. You have any.
I'm thinking as I go. I just want to mention as an anecdote that there is an indigenous community in BC that has sponsored a refugee family. I want to go find them. And I want to talk, and I want to find out how they understand what they are doing, why they are doing it, and how this connects to their vision and aspirations as indigenous peoples. So beyond that, I just thank you for your questions and thoughts.
Just a word about what you said, sir. I don't have any problem with being defining myself as a settler. But as a French Canadian, I'm just going to say this. In my province, the constitutional myth that is the most powerful still today is not the Quiet Revolution. It's the British conquest of 1760. And constitutional myths are extremely powerful and make establishing fruitful relationships possible. So I don't mind defining myself as a settler or being seen as a settler. But if that is the only image that's left in the mind of the indigenous people I meet with, then there's no great chance for us to establish a peaceful relationship. And when Quebecers will stop thinking that the British conquest is the dominating idea of their identity, maybe things will be much easier between the rest of Canada and Quebec.
Please join me in thanking the presenters and the questions.
Thank you very much, Willem, Jean, and Audrey. We'll break now for lunch. I'd like to ask you to follow the conference staff downstairs to the luncheon area, and we'll resume at 2 o'clock. Thank you very much.